Ek omerson tenlos oprax, so that you will know where to position yourself and the several ways to best deflect a well-aimed bolt. Plagueis put his words into action as the first ring of droids began to converge on them, staggering the attack and triggering bursts at random. Orbiting Sidious, the Mune's blade warded off every volley, returning the bolts to their sources, or deflecting them into the facades of the foe buildings surrounding them or into other droids. At other times, Plagueis made no attempt to redirect the attacks, but simply twisted and torqued his rangy body, allowing the bolts to miss him by centimeters. Around the two Sith, the automata collapsed one after the next, gushing lubricants from holed reservoirs, or exploding in a hail of alloy parts, until all were heaped on the ferrocrete floor. "The next ring is yours," Plagueis said. Rugged, uninhabited Hypori belonged to the Techno-Union, whose Skakoan foreman, Wat Tambor, owed his seat in the Republic Senate to Damask Holdings. In exchange, the bionic humanoid had made Hypori available as a training ground for members of the Achani Sun Guard and provided the necessary battle droids. Calling in another favor, Higo Damask had requested a private session in the fabricated cityscape so that Plagueis and his apprentice could be free to employ lightsabers, though only for the purpose of deflecting bolts, rather than dismemberment or penetration. When it came to Sidious's turn to demonstrate his skill, Plagueis spoke continuously from behind him, adding distraction to the distinct possibility of inadvertent disintegration. "A being trained in the killing arts doesn't wait for you to acquire him as a target, or establish him or herself as an opponent, as if in some martial arts contest. Your reactions must be instantaneous and nothing less than lethal, for you are a Sith Lord and will be marked for death." The droids continued to converge, ring after ring of them, until the floor was piled high with smoking husks. Plagueis issued a voice command that brought the onslaught to an abrupt end and deactivated his lightsaber. The pinging of cooling weapons, the hiss of escaping gas, the unsteady whir of failing servo motors punctuated the sudden silence. Alloy limbs spasmed, and photoreceptors winked out, surrendering their eerie glow. The recycled air was rotten with the smell of fried circuitry. "Feast your eyes on your handiwork," Plagueis said, gesturing broadly. Sidious switched off his weapon.
"I see nothing but ruined droids."
Plagueis nodded. "Darth Bane advised, one day the Republic will fall and the Jedi will be wiped out. But that will not happen until we are ready to seize that power for ourselves."
"When?" Sidious said. "How will we know when the time is right?"
"We are close to knowing. For 1,000 years, the Sith have allowed themselves to be reduced to the stuff of folklore. Since it serves our purposes, we've done nothing to counter the belief that we are perversions of the Jedi. Evil magus, embodiments of hatred, rage, and bloodlust. Capable even of leaving the residue of our malefactions and dastardly deeds in places of power."
"Why have we not yet visited those places, Master, instead of worlds like Boyant and Hypori?"
Darth Plagueis gazed at him. "You are impatient. You see no value in learning about weapons or explosives, force suggestion, or the healing arts. You hunger for the power of the sort you imagine is to be found on Korriban, Dromund Kaas, Zigula. Then let me tell you what you'll encounter in those reliquaries. Jedi, treasure hunters, and legends. Of course there are tombs in the Valley of the Dark Lords, but they have been plundered and now draw only tourists. On Duxon, Yavin 4, Zyast, the same is true. If it's history that has caught your fancy,
I can show you 100 worlds on which esoteric Sith symbols have been woven covertly into architecture and culture, and I can bore you for years with tales of the exploits of Freedon Nadd, Belial Zu, Darth Zanna, who is alleged to have infiltrated the Jedi Temple, and of starships imbued with Sith consciousness. Is that your wish, Sidious? To become an academic?
I wish only to learn, Master.
And so you will, but not from spurious sources. We are not some cult like the Tetsu sorcerers of Tund. Descended from Darth Bane, we are the select few who refuse to be carried by the Force and who carry it instead. 30 in a millennium, rather than the tens of thousands fit to be Jedi. Any Sith can feign compassion and self-righteousness and master the Jedi arts. But only one in 1,000 Jedi could ever become a Sith. For the dark side is only for those who value self-determinism over all else that existence offers. Only once in these past 1,000 years has a Sith Lord strayed into the light. And one day I will tell you that tale. But for now, take to heart the fact that Bane's Rule of Two was at the start our saving grace, putting an end to the internecine strife that allowed the Jedi Order to gain the upper hand. Part of our ongoing task will be to hunt down and eliminate any Sith pretenders who pose a threat to our ultimate goals.
Sidious remained silent for a long moment.
Am I to be equally distrustful of the lessons contained in Sith holocrons?
Not distrustful, Plagueis said gravely. But holocrons contain knowledge specific and idiosyncratic to each Sith who constructed them. Real knowledge is passed by master to apprentice in sessions such as this, where nothing is codified or recorded, diluted, and thus it cannot be forgotten. There will come a time when you may wish to consult the holocrons of past masters. But until then, you would do better not to be influenced by them. You must discover the dark side in your own way, and perfect your power in your own fashion. All I can do in the meantime is to help keep you from losing your way while we hide in plain sight from the prying eyes of our enemies.
What celestial body is more luminous than a singularity, Sidious recited. Hiding in plain sight, but more powerful than all.
Plagueis grinned. You are quoting Darth Guile.
He goes on to compare the Sith to a rogue or malignant cell, too small to be discovered by scans or other techniques, but capable of spreading silently and lethally through a system. Initially, the victim simply doesn't feel right, then falls ill, and ultimately succumbs.
Plagueis locked eyes with him.
Consider the mindset of an anarchist who plans to sacrifice himself for a cause. For the weeks, months, possibly years, leading up to the day he straps a thermal detonator to his chest and executes his task, he has lived in and been strengthened by the secret he carries, knowing the toll his act will take. So it has been for the Sith, residing in a secret, sacred place of knowledge for 1,000 years, and knowing the toll our acts will take. This is power, Sidious, where the Jedi, by contrast, are like beings who, as they move among the healthy, keep secret the fact that they are dying of a terminal illness. But true power needn't bear claws or fangs, or announce itself with snarls and throaty barks, Sidious. It can subdue with manacles of shimmer silk, purposeful charisma, and political astuteness.
The location of the planet known to the Sith as Curseed had been expunged from Republic records in distant times, and for the past 600 years had been reserved for use as a place of spectacle. masters and apprentices of the Bane lineage, had visited with enough regularity that a cult had come into being in that part of the world based on the periodic return of the sky visitors. The Sith hadn't bothered to investigate what Curseed's indigenous humanoids thought about the visits, whether in their belief systems the Sith were regarded as the equivalent of deities or demons, since it was unlikely that the primitives had yet so much as named their world. However, visiting as apprentice and, more often than not, as master, each Sith lord had remarked on the slow advancement of Curseed's civilization, how on the early visits the primitives had defended themselves with wooden war clubs and smooth rocks hurled from slings. 200 years later, many of the small settlements had grown to become cities or ceremonial centers built of hewn stone, with social classes of rulers and priests, merchants and warriors. Gradually the cities had become ringed with ranged weapons of a crude sort, and magical guardian symbols had been emblazoned on the sloping sides of defensive walls. At some point previous to Darth Tenebris's visit as an apprentice, replicas of the Sith ships had been constructed in the center of the arid plateau that served as a battleground, and enormous totemic figures, visible only from above, had been outlined by removing tens of thousands of fist-sized volcanic stones that covered the ground. On Plagueis's first visit, some 50 years earlier, the warriors he and Tenebris faced had been armed with longbows and metal-tipped lances. That the Sith had never demanded anything other than battle hadn't kept the primitives from attempting to adopt a policy of appeasement. Leaving at the ship's perpetual landing site, foodstuffs, sacrificial victims, and works of what they considered art, forged of materials they held precious or sacred. But the Sith had simply ignored the offerings, waiting instead on the stony plain for the primitives to deploy their warriors, as the primitives did now with Plagueis and Sidious waiting. Announcing their arrival with low runs over the city, they had set the ship down and waited for 6 days, while the mournful calls of breath-driven horns had disturbed the dry silences, and groups of primitives had flocked in together on the hillsides that overlooked the battleground. "Do you recall what Darth Bane said regarding the killing of innocents?" Plagueis had asked. "Our mission," Sidious paraphrased, "is not to bring death on all those unfit to live. All we do must serve our true purpose, the preservation of our order and the survival of the Sith. We must work to grow our power, and to accomplish that we will need to interact with individuals of many species across many worlds. Eventually, word of our existence will reach the ears of the Jedi." To refrain from senseless killing, they wielded force pikes rather than lightsabers, meter-long melee weapons used by the Ichane and carried by the Senate Guard. The pikes were equipped with stun module tips capable of delivering a shock that could overwhelm the nervous systems of most sentients without causing permanent damage. "The next few hours will test the limits of your agility, speed, and accuracy," Plagueis said, as several hundred of the biggest, bravest, and most skilled warriors, their bodies daubed in pigments derived from plants, clay, and soil, began to separate themselves from the crowds. "But this is more than some simple exercise in proficiency. It is a rite of passage for these beings, as they are assistants in our rise to ultimate power, and therefore servants of the dark side of the Force. Centuries from now, advanced by the Sith, they might confront us with projectile weapons or energy beams. But by then, we will have evolved as well, perhaps past the need for this rite, and we will come instead to honor rather than engage them in battle. Through power, we gain victory, and through victory, our chains are broken. But power is only a means to an end." To the clamorous beating of drums and the wailing of the onlookers, the warriors brandished their weapons, raised a deafening war cry, and attacked. A nod from Plagueis, and the two Sith sped across the plain to meet them, flying among them like wraiths, evading arrows, gleaming spear tips, and blows from battle axes, going one against one, two or three, but felling opponent after opponent with taps from the force pikes, until among the hundreds of jerking, twitching bodies sprawled on the rough ground, only one was left standing. That was when Plagueis tossed aside the stun pike and ignited his crimson blade, and a collective lament rose from the crowds on the hillsides. "Execute one, terrify 1,000," he said. Hurling the warrior to the ground with a force push, he used the lightsaber to deftly open the primitive's chest cavity. Then he reached a hand inside and extracted his still-beating heart. The keening of the crowd reached a fevered pitch as he raised the heart high overhead. Then it ended abruptly. Following a protracted moment of silence, the fallen warriors were helped from the battleground, and the crowds began to disperse, disconsolate but emboldened by the fact that they had discharged their duty. Horns blew, and a communal chant that was at once somber and celebratory was carried on the wind. In the principal city, a stone stele would be carved and erected for the dead one, and the day count would commence until the return of the Sith. Plagueis placed the still heart on the primitive's chest and used the hem of his robe to wipe the blood from his hand and forearm. At one time, though I recognized the Munes are a higher class of beings, I puzzled over the fact that beings would relinquish their seats for me or step into the muck to allow me to pass. But early on in my apprenticeship, I came to realize that the lumpen species were making room for me not because I was immune, but because I was in fact superior to them in every way. More, that they should by all rights allow me to step not merely past them, but on them, to get where I needed to be. Because the Sith are their salvation, their only real hope, in that we will ultimately improve the lives of their descendants. They owe us every courtesy, every sacrifice, nothing short of their very lives. But there are dark times ahead for many of them, Sidious. An era of warfare necessary to purge the galaxy of those who have allowed it to decay. For decay has no cure. It has to be eradicated by the flames of a cleansing fire. And the Jedi are mostly to blame. Crippled by empathy, shackled to obedience, to their masters, their council, their cherished republic. They perpetuate a myth of equality, serving the Force as if it were a belief system that had been programmed into them. With the Republic, they are like indulgent parents, allowing their offspring to experiment with choices without consequence, and supporting wrong-headedness merely for the sake of maintaining family unity, tripping over their own robes in a rush to uphold a galactic government that has been deteriorating for centuries, when instead they should be proclaiming, "We know what's best for you." The galaxy can't be set on the proper course until the Jedi Order and the corrupt Republic have been brought down. Only then can the Sith begin the process of rebuilding from the ground up. This is why we encourage star system rivalries and the goals of any group that aims to foment chaos and anarchy. Because destruction of any sort furthers our own goals. Plagueis paused to take the warrior's heart back into his hands. Through us, the powers of chaos are harnessed and exploited. Dark times don't simply emerge, Sidious. Enlightened beings, guiding intelligences, manipulate events to bring about a storm that will deliver power into the hands of an elite group, willing to make the hard choices the Republic fears to make. Beings may elect their leaders, but the Force has elected us. He glanced at his apprentice. Remember, though, that a cunning politician is capable of wreaking more havoc than two Sith lords armed with vibroblades, lightsabers, or force pikes.
That is what you must become, with me advising you from the dark.
Are we grand enough? Sidious said.
You should ask, are we crude enough?
Plagueis quirked a smile. We're not living in the age of giants, Sidious. But to succeed, we must become as beasts.
Taking a bite from the warrior's heart, he passed the blood-filled organ to his apprentice.
Chapter 14. The Shape of His Shadow.
You appear to be enjoying the steak, Ambassador Palpatine.
Exquisite, he said,
holding her gaze for a fraction longer than might have been called for. Working on her third glass of wine since dinner began, she interpreted his ready smile as permission to turn fully toward him.
Not too gamey?
Scarcely a trace of the wild.
A dark-haired human beauty with big blue eyes, she was attached in some way to the Ariadne Consulate on Malastar, host of the gala at which the Dug winners of the Winter Harvest Classic were being fated.
Are you on Malastar for business or pleasure?
As luck would have it, both,
Palpatine said, patting his lips with a napkin.
Kinmen Doriana and I are members of Senator Kim's party.
He indicated the clean-shaven, slightly balding young man in the adjacent seat.
Charmed, the woman said.
Doriana smiled broadly. You're not kidding. Her gaze moved to the neighboring table, where Vida Kim sat with members of the Grand Protectorate and politicians from nearby Sullust, Docknell, and Sluis Van.
Senator Kim is the tall one with the quaint beard?
No, he's the one with the three eye stalks, Doriana said.
The woman blinked, then laughed with him.
A friend of mine was asking about Senator Kim earlier.
Is he married? For many years, and happily,
Palpatine told her.
And you?
She said, turning to him again.
Frequent travel forbids it.
She watched him over the rim of the wine glass.
Married to politics, is that it?
To the work, he said.
To the work, Doriana said, raising his glass in a toast. Just 28, Palpatine wore his reddish hair long, in the tradition of Naboo statesmen, and dressed impeccably. Many who encountered the ambassador described him as an articulate, charismatic young man of refined taste and quiet strength. A good listener, even-tempered, politically astute, astonishingly well-informed for someone who had only been in the game for 7 years, a patrician at a time when few could claim the title, and destined to go far. Well-traveled, too, courtesy of his position as Naboo's ambassador at large, but also as the sole surviving heir to the wealth of House Palpatine. Long recovered from the tragedy that had struck his family more than a decade earlier, but perhaps as a result of being orphaned at 17, something of a loner, a man whose love of periodic solitude hinted at a hidden side to his personality.
Tell me, Ambassador, she said as she set her glass down. Are you one of those men with a friend in every spaceport?
I'm always eager to make friends, Palpatine said in a low monotone that brought sudden color to her face. We're alike in that way.
Taking her glossy lower lip between her teeth, she reached for her wine glass once more.
Are you perhaps a Jedi mind reader, disguised in ambassadorial robes?
Anything but.
I've often wondered whether they have secret relationships, she said in a conspiratorial voice, gallivanting around the galaxy, using the Force to seduce innocent beings.
I wouldn't know, but I sincerely doubt it, Palpatine said.
She looked at him in a calculating way and raised her hand to caress his chin with a manicured forefinger.
On Eriadu, some believe that a cleft chin identifies someone the Force has pushed away.
Just my luck, he said in mock seriousness.
Just your luck indeed, she said, sliding a flimsy card across the table toward him.
I have hostess duties to attend to, Ambassador. but I'm free after midnight. Palpatine and Doriana watched her walk away from the table, teetering slightly on high heels.
Nicely played, Doriana said. I'm taking notes.
Palpatine slid the flimsy card toward him. A gift.
When you earned it? Doriana shook his head. I'm not that desperate. Yet, anyway.
The two of them laughed. Doriana's engaging smile and innocent good looks belied a sinister personality that had brought him to Palpatine's notice several years earlier. A Naboo, he had a troubled past and, perhaps as a consequence, talents that made him useful. So Palpatine had befriended him and clandestinely drawn him into his web, in accordance with Plagueis' instructions that he always keep an eye out for allies and would-be co-conspirators. That Doriana wasn't strong in the Force made no difference. In 11 years of Sith apprenticeship and of traveling far and wide in the galaxy, Palpatine had yet to encounter a single being whose strength in the Force had gone unrecognized or unexploited. At the neighboring table, Vidar Kim and the rest were enjoying themselves, their privacy ensured by the table's transparent sound-muting umbrella. Envy gnawed at Palpatine while he watched Kim. The position he enjoyed in the Galactic Senate, the posting on Coruscant, easy access to the galaxy's elite. But he knew that he needed to bide his time, that Plagueis would move him to the galactic capital only when there was some good reason to do so. As often as Plagueis maintained that the rule of two had ended with their partnership, the Mune remained the powerful one, and Palpatine the covetous one. Bane's dictum notwithstanding, denial was still a key factor in Sith training, a key factor in being broken, as Plagueis put it, of being shaped by the dark side of the Force, cruelly at times and painfully. But Palpatine was grateful, for the Force had slowly groomed him into a being of dark power and granted him a secret identity as well. The life he had been leading, as the noble head of House Palpatine, legislator, and most recently ambassador at large, was nothing more than the trappings of an alter ego. His wealth, a subterfuge. His handsome face, a mask. In the realm of the Force, his thoughts ordered reality, and his dreams prepared the galaxy for monumental change. He was a manifestation of dark purpose, helping to advance the Sith grand plan, and gradually gaining power over himself, so that he might one day, in the words of his master, be able to gain control over another, then a group of others, then an order, a world, a species, the Republic itself. Doriana's elbow nudged him out of his reverie. Kim's coming.
Don't think I didn't see that, the senator said when he reached Palpatine.
Palpatine let his bafflement show.
The flimsy card that woman slipped you,
Vidar said.
I suppose you entertained her with the usual tall tales?
Palpatine shrugged in a guileless manner.
I may have said something about getting to know the galaxy.
Getting to know the galaxy's women, he means, Doriana interjected. Kim laughed heartily.
How is it that I come to have assistants who leave trails of conquests, and a son who meditates on the Force in the Jedi Temple?
That's what makes you so well-rounded, Doriana said.
More than even Plagueis, Kim had been Palpatine's mentor in the sphere of mundane politics. Their relationship went back 15 years, to when Palpatine had been forcibly enrolled in a private school in Theed, and Kim had just completed his stint in the apprentice legislator program. In the time since, Palpatine had watched Kim's family grow to include 3 sons, one of whom, Ranhar, 6 years Palpatine's junior, had been turned over to the Jedi Order as an infant.
When Plagueis had learned of this, he had encouraged Palpatine to allow his friendship with Kim to deepen, in the expectation that sooner or later, his and Jedi Ranhar's paths would cross.
Give order to the future by attending to it with your thoughts, his master frequently told him.
Come and join us at the table, Kim was saying.
Palpatine stood and fell into step beside Kim as he headed back to the larger table.
One day you'll be replacing me at this job, the senator said quietly. And the sooner you grow accustomed to what goes on, the better.
He sighed with purpose.
Who knows? A few hours of senatorial gossip might even be enough to deter you from going into galactic politics altogether.
Some dozen beings were grouped in a circle, all of them male but not all of them human. The prominent chairs were occupied by Grand Protectorate Senator Pak's team and his aide, Ox Mo. To both sides of them sat Solistan and Sluisi senators. Also present were Eriaduan Senator Ranulf Tarkin and his aide, Bor Gracchus, the Darknell Ambassador, and Duggs, Bos Cabra, a Black Sun Vigo, and his son, Darnada, guests of the Podrace winners and attendees of the most recent gathering on Sojourn. By then, Palpatine had made 3 visits to the Hunter's Moon, but only to observe and to familiarize himself with some of the galaxy's key players. Plagueis, as Higo Damask, had gone to great lengths to avoid being identified as Palpatine's benefactor. Only King Tapalo's chief minister, Ars Varuna, knew that Damask was grooming him for a career in galactic politics, and, as a personal favor to the Moon, had appointed Palpatine Naboo's ambassador.
Ah, new blood,
Pak's team remarked after Kim had introduced Palpatine to everyone.
I quite enjoyed the pod races, Palpatine said as he sat down.
Team's leaf-like ears twitched.
You're too young to have witnessed them in their glory days, Ambassador, before Tatooine succeeded in capturing the fancy of race enthusiasts.
The Grand pronounced Tatooine as if an execration. Palpatine knew that Plagueis had been responsible for Tatooine's rise, as well as for weakening Malastare's once lucrative trade in fuel by helping to make Naboo's plasma resources available to many worlds.
Have your duties taken you to that horrible place?
Ox Mo asked. Palpatine nodded as he sat.
Just 2 months ago.
And how did you find it?
Cabra said. Palpatine turned to the Dug crime boss.
Contentious? What with the Dasilajic and Basadi huts vying for control?
The statement met with murmurs of concurrence. Team spoke to it.
Perhaps Gardula's rivalry with Jabba Teor will one day result in Malastare's resurgence.
His eye stalks twisted toward the Dugs.
Though I'm certain Bos Cabra favors Gardula, out of respect for the help she provided on Nar Shadda.
Young Darnada bristled at the remark.
Whatever mark we've made on Nar Shadda, we made on our own. Ask any Black Sun.
Stopping him before he could go on, Cabra said,
We will always be indebted to Gardula for her efforts on our behalf.
Kim watched the Dugs, then gestured negligently.
Tatooine is too remote and lawless to have an impact on galactic events in any case. It's the activities of the Trade Federation that should concern the Republic. Look what the Federation has done to our own Naboo.
Kim became the object of everyone's gaze, an outspoken critic of King Tapalo and Ars Varuna. He continued to serve in the Senate, only as an appeasement to those noble houses that were aligned against the regent.
It is my understanding that Naboo embraced the arrangement,
Ranulf Tarkin said.
Some did. No one can deny that your world has prospered as a result,
Team interjected.
Prospered, yes, Kim said, but not nearly to the extent it should have. If not for the deals Higo Damask brokered with the banking clan, the Trade Federation, and...
He glanced at Cabra.
Outer Rim construction? Naboo would be as wealthy as Kuat or Chandrila.
The Dug remained silent while Kim continued.
Naboo's plasma is being sold for 10, sometimes 20 times what the Federation pays for it.
A monster of our own creation, Tarkin muttered.
The Trade Federation didn't become powerful by exploiting the Outer Rim. It was supported by Eriadu's own House Valorum, and supported by Targ and others. Then perhaps the time has come for us to make our dissatisfaction public, Kim said, glancing around the table. The Munes are merely avaricious, but the Trade Federation has the potential to become dangerous.
I agree with the good senator from Naboo, the Celestine delegate said. Even now, the Trade Federation seeks to seat its client worlds in the Senate as a means of fortifying its voting bloc. Metchus, Makana, Felucia, Kolhoro, Ord Cestus, Yencha, the list goes on and on.
The Sluisi senator made a sound of disapproval, and a tremor seemed to snake through his humanoid upper torso.
Don't dismiss too lightly the part the Munes play in all this. Yinchor's Senate seat was Damask Holding's doing.
He looked at Cabra.
Is that not the case?
The dog's powerful shoulders heaved.
I'm not in a position to know.
Laughter from the others prompted Darnada to part his muzzle just enough to reveal the tips of his fangs. The Sluisi looked at Kim and Palpatine.
Perhaps Black Sun is unaware that the son of Higo Damask's operating officer, Lash Hill, is in line to replace Toneth as chairman of the banking clan.
Tarkin put his elbows on the table and leaned forward.
I've heard the rumors to the effect that Damask has been meeting with the heads of the guilds, the Corporate Alliance, and the Techno Union. What might become of trade of any sort if he brokered a deal between them and the Trade Federation? Here's the point, Kim said. If we're going to prevent the Trade Federation and the Munes from tightening their hold on the Senate, we need to band together and vote to defeat the proposed legislation.
Before Kim could add anything, Tarkin said to Palpatine,
Do you agree that the Trade Federation needs to be taken down a notch, Ambassador?
Palpatine glanced at Kim, who said,
Speak freely. Senator Kim and I are in complete accord on the issue, and have been for some time. No single corporate entity can be allowed to grow too powerful, especially at the expense of developing worlds. Naboo must safeguard its interests, just as Eriadu and Sullust and Sluis Van have safeguarded theirs.
Tarkin watched him closely.
Is Naboo prepared to assume control of transporting its plasma? Aren't you in danger of biting the proverbial hand that feeds you?
Naboo has no intentions of planetizing the Trade Federation's facilities. We're simply pressing for a renegotiation of the original contracts. Tarkin thought about it.
So you feel that a defeat in the Senate might make the Trade Federation more, pliable, as it were?
Palpatine vouchsafed a thin smile.
Only those bills that support well-reasoned regulation should win approval in the Senate. Well put, Tarkin said.
Palpatine waited for someone to point out that he had offered nothing of substance, but no one did. Even Kim failed to grasp that he was being undermined. Pak's team was about to speak when a Gran messenger intruded on the privacy canopy.
Senator Kim, we are in receipt of an urgent communique from Naboo.
While Kim was excusing himself, Palpatine dropped into the Force. Conversation at the table grew faint, and the physical forms of Pak's team and the others became indistinct, more like blurs of lambent energy. He kept himself still as a disturbing echo reached him. By the time an ashen Kim was returning to the table, Palpatine was already out of his seat and hurrying to meet him.
What is it? What happened?
Kim stared at him as if from another world.
They're dead. Everyone. My wife, my sons.
And he collapsed, sobbing, against Palpatine's shoulder. The funeral for the Kim family was everything it hadn't been for the Palpatines. In keeping with tradition, the bodies of Kim's wife, two sons, and the ship's pilot and co-pilot had been returned to Theed from the crash site in seaside Ka'adara and cremated in the funeral temple. A procession hundreds strong, led by King Tapolo and his chief advisors, proceeded on foot from the temple to the nearby Livit Tower, where everyone spent a moment gathered around the eternal flame, contemplating transience and the importance of living an harmonious life. Then moved in solemn precision to the banks of the Solyu River, where the grief-stricken senator scattered the ashes and wept openly as the current carried them over the Vedugo Plunge to the flatlands beyond. Following the ceremony, mourners gathered to express their condolences to Vidar Kim, who wore a robe of deep green over a black tunic. When Palpatine's turn came, the two men embraced.
"I have only one hope for a family, Palpatine. One hope."
Kim's eyes were red-rimmed and brimming with tears.
"Ranha."
Palpatine compressed his lips in uncertainty.
"He is a Jedi Knight, Vidar. His family is the Order."
Kim was insistent.
"I need him more than the Order needs him. Only he can carry the Kim line forward, just as you will someday carry on the Palpatine line."
Palpatine said nothing. With vehicular traffic banned from Theed's narrow streets, the city seemed almost as it had a decade earlier, before antiquated laws had been repealed and wealth had worked its dubious magic. Before flash speeders and R2 astromech droids had become the rage, and fads and fashions in dress, transport, and food had poured in from the core. The murders of Kosinga and the others had left Palpatine emancipated and wealthy. Though interrogated by numerous officials, he had been absolved, his story, his alibi, accepted. Some of the influential nobles had their suspicions that Palpatine had furnished intelligence to Damask Holdings to secure the election of Bon Tapolo, but most Naboo had offered sympathy and support. On the heels of Tapolo's ascension to the throne, Palpatine had sold the Lake Country estate and taken an apartment in Theed, stocking it with extra system art that had found its way to Naboo from Kor and Midrim worlds. In the early years of his apprenticeship to Darth Plagueis, he had remained in mandatory public service. He then spent 5 years in the Apprentice Legislator program before being appointed ambassador following Tapolo's re-election. Palpatine supposed he could have lobbied for a more prestigious position, but only at the risk of undermining Plagueis. Equally important, a high-status post might have interfered with his ability to rendezvous with his Sith master on remote worlds, where they had been able to be observed together without consequence. As he left Kim to the next mourner in line, he noticed Ars Varuna separating himself from a group that included Palpatine's allies Kinmon Doriana and Janus Grigatus. "A word, Ambassador," Varuna said when he drew near. Palpatine allowed himself to be steered by the elbow into an unoccupied viewing area near the Solyu Bridge.
"My heart goes out to poor Vidar," Varuna began. Roughly the same height as Palpatine, he wore a brocaded cloak and tall headpiece. "A starship crash of all things. One would have thought that a tragedy of such nature might have compelled him to retire from politics, but that doesn't appear to be the case."
He rested his elbows on the stone balustrade and gazed at the fast-moving river.
"Well, you of all people would know better than most the effect of such unforeseen developments. Vidar is planning to return to Coruscant before the month is out."
"On Senate business?"
"Personal, I suspect."
Varuna grew pensive, then said,
"The last time you and I stood together was at the inaugural ceremony for the plasma generator."
He turned to regard Palpatine.
"You look well. Changed, I think. From your travels?"
"Broadened," Palpatine said.
"The very word I was searching for."
Varuna paused briefly.
"It has reached my ear that you made quite an impression on Sespena Sector Senator Ranulf Tarkin when you were on Malastare recently."
Palpatine shrugged.
"I wasn't aware." He enjoyed hearing your views regarding the Trade Federation's plan to seat some of its client worlds in the Senate. Would you care to elaborate on what you told him?
Palpatine smiled lightly.
I offered nothing substantive. In fact, I was merely playing politics.
Varuna nodded knowingly.
I am greatly relieved to hear that.
He glanced around before continuing.
As you well know, the King and I have our separate arrangements with the Trade Federation. Now, however, we are forced to take into account the discontent of our constituents. Unfortunately, the person largely responsible for Tapelo's election and our party's continued popularity is not going to take kindly to hearing that Naboo plans to vote against the very legislation Damask Holdings has been lobbying to see enacted.
I can appreciate your predicament, Palpatine said. Why not order Senator Kim to vote in favor of the Trade Federation?
Varuna laughed shortly.
Would that it were as simple as that. The problem is that Kim knows about our separate arrangements and intends to use this opportunity to send a message to the Trade Federation, as well as to Tapelo's detractors, that Naboo will no longer allow itself to be exploited.
He inhaled deeply.
Recalling him from Coruscant would be tantamount to admitting that Naboo remains at the mercy of the Trade Federation, and might jeopardize our standing with many of the trade worlds on whom we have come to depend.
Palpatine pretended to consider it.
Perhaps it will be worth the risk to vote against the Trade Federation.
Varuna studied him with sudden interest.
Go on.
Whether the legislation is enacted or becomes embroiled in procedure, Naboo's contracts with the Trade Federation will remain binding and inalterable. The Federation will continue procuring our plasma for meager credits and marketing it for inflated prices. But Naboo will at least be on the public record as having stood up to the galactic conglomerates.
More playing politics, is that it?
Palpatine rocked his head from side to side, but said nothing.
And what about Magister Damask? Apprise him of the plan beforehand. He's not unreasonable.
Varuna stroked his beard in thought.
That just might work.
He smiled slyly.
It's a pity Naboo already has a voice in the Senate.
Palpatine sniffed.
Should the opportunity ever arise, I would of course accept. But until then, I'm content to serve in my own way.
Serve Naboo.
Who or what else?
Varuna rubbed his hands together.
One day, if I have my way, our Space Corps will include a fleet of swift Nubian fighters, capable of chasing the Trade Federation from our system.
I too foresee the day, Palpatine said.
Varuna laughed again.
Ah, but when? How long will we have to wait, Palpatine?
Only until Higo Damask awards you the throne.
Chapter 15 Quantum Being. A gift to Damask from the Council of Elders on the occasion of Yenchor's seating in the Senate, the towering reptilian condemned murderer shuffled to the center of the energy field that defined his cage on Abora, and with confusion contorting the features of his beaked face, prostrated himself on the permacrete floor and mumbled in Basic,
"I'm honored to be here and to perform whatever tasks you require of me."
Standing at the field's shimmering perimeter, 114D pivoted his head toward Plagueis.
"Congratulations, Magister. At last he responds to your suggestion. You have undermined his resolve."
That resolve, Plagueis had learned after more than 2 years of experimentation on the Yinchori, was in fact a kind of force bubble, fashioned by the turtle-like alien's limited number of unusually willful midichlorians. This suggested that the Yinchori was actually strong in the Force, despite his pitifully low count. The discovery had come as a breakthrough, and Plagueis was still grappling with the implications. The Force bubble itself was similar to those generated by creatures that drew on the Force to avoid predation by natural enemies. The relationship between the arboreal Isalamir
and its adversary, the Vornsker, provided a curious example, in that the latter was attracted to the former by the very mechanism the Asalamir employed as a defense. Where an extremely low midichlorian count might have bolstered the odds of survival, nature had instead made the Asalamir species strong in the force. So strong, in fact, that several of the creatures acting in concert could create a force bubble encompassing kilometers rather than meters. In a sense, the Jedi Order had done the same on a galactic scale, Plagueis believed, by bathing the galaxy in the energy of the light side of the Force, or more accurately, by fashioning a Force bubble that had prevented infiltration by the dark side, until Tenebris's master had succeeded in bursting the bubble, or at least shrinking it. How the Order's actions could be thought of as balancing the Force had baffled generations of Sith, who harbored no delusions regarding the Force's ability to self-regulate. The Yenchuri former convict wasn't the only new addition to Plagueis' island facility. In the 11 years that had elapsed since the capture of Venomous and the recruitment of Sidious, Plagueis had collected more than a dozen beings of diverse species and had been subjecting them to a wide range of experiments involving volition, telepathy, healing, regeneration, and life extension, with some promising results. As for the Bith would-be Sith Lord, he was alive and well, though kept comatose more often than not, and always under the watchful photoreceptors of 114D or a host of custodial droids. Plagueis hadn't lost interest in Venomous by any means, but the Yenchuri's immunity to force suggestion, an immunity the species shared with Hutts, Toydarians, and others, had provided him with a new line of investigation. Unlike Isilimiri, which created a force bubble in the presence of danger, the Yenchuri were in perpetual state of involuntary immunity to force suggestion. The fact that immunity was in a sense hardwired into them meant that the ability was an adaptation prompted by a past threat to the survival of the species. To Plagueis, it meant that the Yenchuri's midichlorians had evolved to provide protection to a species that was naturally strong in the Force. If that were indeed the case, then the Yenchuri were living proof that the Sith of the Bane line had been on the right path from the very start. For while toppling the Jedi Order and the Republic was essential to the task of restoring order to the galaxy, that goal belonged to the realm of the ordinary, to the world that was nothing more than a byproduct of the eternal struggle between the light and dark forces, both of which were beyond any concepts of good or evil. The greater goal of the Sith involved toppling the Force itself and becoming the embodiment of the galaxy's animating principle. It had been theorized by Jedi and Sith alike that balance between the light and dark sides was actually under the guidance of a group of discorporate entities, the ones called the Celestials, perhaps, who had merged themselves with the Force thousands of generations earlier and had continued to guide the fate of the galaxy ever since. In effect, a higher order of intermediaries whose powers were beyond the understanding of mortal beings. But many Sith viewed the notion with disdain, for the theoretical existence of such a group had little bearing on the goal of making the Force subservient to the will of an enlightened elite. Only the Sith understood that sentient life was on the verge of a transformative leap, that through the manipulation of midichlorians, or the overthrow of the forceful group that supervised them, the divide between organic life and the Force could be bridged, and death could be erased from the continuum. As evidenced by those few lords who had managed to perpetuate their spirits after physical death, foremost among them, Emperor Vitiate, who was said to have lived 1,000 years, the ancient Sith had come halfway across that bridge. But those few had been so focused on worldly power that they had ended up trapping themselves between realms, that they had never provided the Order with guidance from beyond, attested to the fact that their influence had been negligible and had long since faded from the world. In the same way that the pre-Bane Sith had been responsible for their own extinction, the great dark side lords of the past had doomed themselves to the nether realm through their attempts to conquer death by feeding off the energies of others, rather than by tapping the deepest strata of the Force and learning to speak the language of the midichlorians. Plagueis was finally learning to do that, and was just beginning to learn how to persuade, prompt, cajole, and coax them into action. Already he could command them to promote healing, and now he had been successful in enticing them to lower their defenses. If he could compel a murderous Yinchori to become peaceful, could he, with a mere suggestion, accomplish the opposite by turning a peaceful being into a murderer? Would he one day be able to influence the leaders of worlds and systems to act according to his designs, however iniquitous? Would he one day conquer not only death but life as well, by manipulating midichlorians to produce forceful beings, even in the absence of fertilization, as Darth Tenebris might have attempted to do with gene-splicing techniques and computers? Perhaps. But not until the singular flame of the light side was extinguished from the galaxy. Not until the Jedi Order was stamped out. From the start of his apprenticeship with Plagueis, his master had demanded to know what Palpatine regarded as his greatest strength, so that he would know how best to undermine him, to know his greatest fear, so that Plagueis would know which to force Palpatine to face, to know what Palpatine cherished most, so that Plagueis could take that from him, and to know the things that Palpatine craved, so that Plagueis could deny him. Some combination of the strictures, or perhaps recognition on Plagueis' part for his apprentice's unabated craving to visit Sith worlds, had landed Palpatine on scenic Dathomir. Sparsely populated and largely unexplored, Dathomir wasn't Korriban or Zyost, but it was powerful in the Force, in part because of its fecundity, but mainly due to the presence of groups of female adepts who practiced darkside magics. He was meandering without clear purpose through one of Blue Desert City's dustier quarters, far from the city center, when he became aware of a faint pulse of Force energy, the origin of which was indistinct but close at hand. Calling more deeply on the Force, he allowed himself to be drawn toward the mysterious source as if he were a starship surrendering to the embrace of a tractor beam. A tortuous series of turns delivered him into a market area brimming with knockoff goods, ersatz jewelry, and bits and pieces of junk that had found its way to Dathomir from who knew where, and ultimately to a small square amid the hustle and bustle, on one corner of which stood a human female, whose symmetrically blemished face was the color of burnished durasteel, and whose flamboyant clothing identified her as a visitor to the city, likely from some remote village on the planet's far side. The hood of her crimson robe was raised, and from one shoulder hung a soft bag the size of a small suitcase. Palpatine moved to the square's diagonal corner to observe her. She was eyeing individuals in the passing crowd, not as if searching for someone in particular, but with a gaze more in keeping with target acquisition. She didn't strike Palpatine as a thief or pickpocket, though she did exude a dark energy informed by equal measures of urgency and deceit. Abruptly, he made himself discernible in the Force, and immediately she turned her head in his direction and began to hurry across the square in his direction.
"Good sir,"
she said in Basic as she drew near. Feigning interest in the cheap wares of an itinerant trader, he pretended to be taken by surprise when she approached him from his blind side.
"Are you addressing me?"
he asked, turning to her.
"I am, sir. If you've a moment to indulge a being in need."
Her oblique eyes were rimmed by dark blemishes that matched the tint of her thick lips. Poking from the wide sleeves of her robe, the tapered fingers of her hands bore long, talon-like nails. Palpatine pretended impatience.
"Why single me out among this crowd of more richly attired beings?"
"Because you have the look and bearing of a man of intelligence and influence.
she gestured broadly. The rest are rabble, despite their fine cloaks and headwear. He made a decorous show of suppressing a yawn.
Save your adulation for the rubes, woman. But since you've correctly identified me as better than the rest, you're obviously aware that I've no time to waste on confidence games or tricks. So if it's mere credits you're after, I suggest you widen your search for someone more charitable.
I don't ask for credits, she said.